It's Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley, and it's time for the New Hampshire News Recap. A jury found that the state enabled child abuse at a former youth detention center. Those jurors awarded a New Hampshire man $38 million in the landmark lawsuit. Now they're speaking out after the state announced that it would cap that amount award. NHPR's Jason Moon has been following the case, and he joins us now with more. Welcome, Jason.
Good morning, Rick.
Jason, first, tell us more about the verdict in the case, which came down last week.
Yeah, I mean, it was historic. It was a big deal. $38 million, like you said, was awarded to David Meehan. According to his attorneys, that's the largest civil jury award in state history. It was also the first time a jury declared that the state of New Hampshire was responsible for the child abuse at YDC. That's a big moment in this whole scandal, which has been unfolding for the last 5 years. So it was a big moment, and then it got confusing with this with the verdict award and the cap that you mentioned.
Yeah, the state says it's going to cap this award, and it's a significant cap. Why?
It's quite a cap. Yeah, $38 million was awarded, but there is a state law on the books that says if you sue a state agency for negligence and they're liable per incident, the max damages you can get is $475,000. So that's obviously a big difference from $38 million. The jury did not know about the cap when they were deciding the verdict in the case, and it comes down to the number of incidents that the jury found happened in David Meehan's case. On the jury verdict form, they said there was one incident and a $38 million award. Since the verdict was announced, a couple of jurors have reached out to Meehan's attorneys in anguish. One juror said they were losing sleep once they found out about this cap. Another juror wrote in to say that they had basically misunderstood what was meant by the word incident. And, you know, I got to tell you, in the juror's defense, it's a complicated case. And if you look on the jury verdict form, you know, what is an incident? Well, it's defined as an episode. You know, what is an episode? It's an incident. This juror said that they considered the complex PTSD that David Meehan has been diagnosed with as the incident of harm that he's suffering when the evidence in the case that showed that he had been raped hundreds of times by state employees. So, you know, usually a verdict in a trial is a moment of clarity. You find out what happened, you get a result. In this case, quite the opposite.
Sure.
And it's still unfolding as to, you know, what is it exactly going to happen with this award. The latest is that the judge declined a request by Meehan's attorneys to quickly reconvene the jury to sort of ask them, hey, what did you guys mean? He's not going to do that, but he is going to entertain other motions on this case to perhaps alter the verdict, alter the damages, I should
and
say.
And I think he said something, possibly could be a new trial.
That is one possibility. Outcome.
Now, how common is it, Jason, for jurors to speak out like this following a trial? I mean, you know, what recourse is there for David Meehan here to receive that full award of $38 million?
Yeah, it's pretty weird. Like I said, it's usually a verdict is a moment of clarity and things are settled at that mm-hmm. point. But, you know, at least a couple of these jurors were very upset that they did not know about this cap and said that they would have changed how they filled out the jury verdict form had they known about it. Obviously, Meehan's attorneys agree and you know are showing these emails that they've been getting to the judge and saying, look, we need to fix this. This is not what the jury intended to be the final outcome. Like you said, a new trial is one possible outcome. I think it's fair to say no one really wants to do that. This trial took, you know, over 4 weeks.
And took years to come to be,
exactly. Yeah. The judge has raised the possibility that apparently there's precedent in New Hampshire case law that he could alter the damages, that he could sort of step in and adjust the damages awarded by the jury. So that's a possibility. But look, you know, there's a lot of money on the line. This is $38 million that obviously the state attorneys are not going to there's going to be a dispute about all of this, and it's, you know, whatever the outcome is, it's likely to be appealed, and this whole situation may very well end up at the state Supreme Court. So,
The state does not want to set precedent here, obviously.
Right, and you know, if you look at the outcome of the case, you know, the jury found the state liable for this abuse, bad outcome, right? But in terms of the actual payout, if it is capped at $475,000, that's a pretty good outcome from the state's perspective and just the pure math of the situation. So, you know, they're probably not going to give up on that cap, you know, very easily.
Right.
So,
yeah,
this will probably be argued and litigated about for you know, weeks and months to come.
But I mean, this brings about the question, Jason. You know, there are many pending civil cases and settlements here with the state surrounding the abuse that took place at the former youth detention center. So, what are you looking for next in your reporting? What do you think will be the next step here?
Yeah, well, like everyone else, I want to find out, you know, how much David Meehan's actually going to get paid. And I think that's a huge factor for everyone else who has those pending lawsuits. You know, you mentioned David Meehan was the first lawsuit mm-hmm. filed, the first one to get to trial. There's about 1,100 others behind him.
Yeah. Are things on hold until this is decided?
The next trial is scheduled for this fall. So we're likely to get some answers before then. But people are, meanwhile, deciding about whether they should continue their lawsuits against the state or go through the state's YDC settlement fund, which offers payouts that probably would be less, but it's a much quicker, less painful
going
process.
Going through trials and all of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll just add that you know, folks who I've been talking to who were also residents at YDC, who also say they were abused there, have been watching this trial. And this whole situation has been difficult for them. Re-traumatizing, they say. You know, it's hard to see this process play out. They feel like it is happening again. You know, the state is getting away with something again. So I'll be looking to see what happens, and they will too.
Jason Moon, host and senior producer on NHPR's Document Team. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thanks, Rick.
And I should note for our listeners, Jason, The 13th Step, it's a podcast that you helped produce, was named as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Audio Journalism. That's a huge achievement. Congratulations,
thanks,
Jason. And
to
your team, Lauren Chilgen, and the entire team that did that. Now, dozens of New Hampshire college students were arrested last week at pro-Palestinian protests at Dartmouth College and UNH. Critics of those demonstrations, including Governor Chris Sununu and leaders at both schools, have warned that so-called outside agitators were involved. Arrest logs from both protests do show a handful of people not affiliated with either school swept up in the arrests, including several people in their 70s and 80s. NHPR's Kate Dario spoke with one man, the oldest person arrested last week, to learn more about what is driving his activism.
Douglas Smith lives in Sharon, Vermont. He's 83 years old, legally blind, asthmatic, epileptic, and a cancer patient. But since the onset of the war in Gaza in October, he has not let these ailments prevent him from attending weekly vigils around the Upper Valley for the civilians killed in the conflict.
When I see pictures of women and children in Gaza being dug out of the rubble, I weep, literally.
When Smith heard there was going to be an encampment set up on the Dartmouth Green on May 1st, he wanted to join in, even though it has been decades since he's been in school himself.
I wanted to support the students, and I asked the students, does my presence as an old guy, do you want that? And they said, yes, of course, of course.
Palestine!
Smith set up a tent with a group of his friends, other activists who've done this for decades, including people in their 70s. They were arrested alongside the students. Smith protested the Vietnam War as a student in Boston. He said today's police seem more militarized and technologically advanced than they did then.
You have 5 minutes to leave this area or you'll be under arrest for the crime of criminal trespass.
These days, the Dartmouth campus is the logical place for him to express his opinions. It's a hub of community life and somewhere local that is connected to international politics.
That happens to be the biggest institution in our area that is invested in the Israeli arms business.
Smith was one of 89 people arrested and charged with criminal trespassing last Wednesday by Hanover and State Police for refusing to leave the green. And, as a condition of his bail, he is banned from Dartmouth property. But that is not deterring him from continuing his activism.
I'm sure there will be other protests on the Dartmouth Green. I will have to stand on the sidewalk near the corner there across from the Hanover Inn. And I will be holding a sign that is in support of the people of Israel and the people of Palestine.
He's scheduled to be arraigned on July 15th. Kate Dario, NHPR News.
Now, you can find Kate's full story at our website, nhpr.org. The Boston Globe's Amanda Gokey has also been following the aftermath of last week's protests at Dartmouth and the University of New Hampshire, and she joins us on the New Hampshire News Recap now. Good morning, Amanda.
Hi, Rick.
Good to have you here, Amanda. Two student journalists arrested while covering the protest at Dartmouth. And last week, it seemed that the college would not be dropping charges. But this week, officials changed course. Amanda, tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's right. So on Tuesday of this week, the Dartmouth president, Sion Bielock, put out an open letter and said that the two students should not have been arrested. In that letter, she also apologized for the harm that her decision to request police assistance in clearing the encampment last week caused, but she said that she stood by that decision. And by Wednesday, the Grafton Assistant County Attorney had filed a motion in court removing the bail conditions against those two students that had barred them from entering the green and other parts of the Dartmouth campus, as well as the president's residence. So those two student journalists were Alessandra Gonzalez and Charlotte Hampton, and they had been granted permission to cover the protest. They were wearing press identification, but they were arrested anyways and charged with criminal trespass. So while the journalists and the student newspaper's editorial board had called for those charges to be dropped last week, Dartmouth's president only agreed to do so after the school was facing scrutiny from national organizations, including one that rates universities on free speech.
And you reported that nine Indigenous Dartmouth students who were arrested will not be able to attend the annual powwow this weekend under the conditions of their bail. What did the students you talked with say about that?
So I spoke with three of the nine students who were impacted by this. And, you know, just for a little bit of context, Dartmouth has a very robust Indigenous program and community. It's really touted itself as an inclusive community for Indigenous students from around the country. It has a fly-in program, so it's using this very actively in its recruitment efforts to attract that type of student. And all of the students that I spoke to really said they were very disappointed in how the college has handled their participation in what was a peaceful protest that did take place on the college's central green. So, you know, as we've already spoken about, one of the conditions of their bail was that they're not allowed to re-enter the green. Both of them, the students have their court dates are set for later in the summer. And so that prevents them from attending this event, the powwow, which is scheduled to take place this weekend.
And officials responding to this in any way?
Yes. So we have heard on Tuesday in President Bielock's open letter to students, she, you know, apologized again for the harm, but stood by her decision. And she said that she's going to have her administration work with students to try to find a solution so that they can attend the powwow, as well as luau, which is, you know, a Native Hawaiian celebration that's scheduled for the day after the powwow. She basically said the university does not have unilateral authority to just lift the restrictions that have been placed by local authorities, but that they're working towards some sort of resolution in supporting these students, but she didn't give specifics about exactly how that would be accomplished.
Now, University of New Hampshire President James Dean, I want to talk about UNH for a minute. He's stepping down later this summer. You spoke with him, I know, this week about his tenure. How did he address the protests on campus last week?
So protests on UNH had been relatively calm, and there was little university or even police presence at these events. I should say university officials attending these events until last Wednesday. That really marked a change. It was the same time as when we saw the state police troops called to Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. And students at UNH, all similarly to Dartmouth, briefly erected an encampment, and that was met with police force on both sides. There were less arrests at UNH, only 12, but videos show those arrests unfolding in, you know, very fast and kind of chaotic way.
We have to leave it there. Amanda Gokey, a reporter for the Boston Globe. Amanda, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Rick.
You can find more of her work at bostonglobe.com/New Hampshire. And you can find the other stories that we talked about this morning, as usual, at our website, nhpr.org. And we're here next Friday with more top headlines, as always. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.